Police is without a chief once again after Mayor Ed Ganey's pick for the top cop retired and stepped down as acting chief. Now it's back to the drawing board, and folks across the city have their own feelings about what they're looking for.
I'm frustrated because I don't see anything getting any better.
Mary Tolomeo is concerned for Pittsburgh and the safety of folks throughout the city.
It seems everything is getting out of hand.
Knowing many people directly impacted by crime.
When I know people of having fights and shootings near their homes, and they don't feel safe in their own homes.
And with Mayor Ed Ganey back to square one in the search for a police chief, she's ready for change and more stability up top. After acting chief Christopher Ragland withdrew his candidacy for the job on Tuesday, and former chief Larry Scarrato suddenly retired to become a full-time basketball referee last fall.
We need more consistent leadership in our police.
Reliability is also what Joyce Boyle is looking for. She lives on Mount Washington, where, like other neighborhoods, folks are facing an ongoing car theft and break-in problem. And on top of that, she's tired of what she says are long response times.
We've had shots up there, like, you know, shot spotters go off, and they take 45 minutes to get up there sometimes.
For Ken Grabowski, who frequently visits the city from Shaler, it's about protecting folks downtown. He still doesn't feel comfortable out in some areas during certain times of the day.
Make it the ability for people to come down to Pittsburgh again and be safe to walk around the streets.
As he resigned, Ragland suggested his nomination became a victim of politics. People say they're losing trust in the process.
Everything is becoming political. So, yeah, I'm losing confidence in whoever comes in is really going to do what they expected to do.
In Pittsburgh, Lauren Linder, KDK TV News.
All I'm going to say is that during this process, I didn't feel that I could lead the Bureau in a way that was morally and ethically in line with my thoughts and desires.
KDKA's Jennifer Barrasso following the story for us from Pittsburgh Police Headquarters. She spoke to Mayor Ganey about his police chief pick's decision to drop out. Jen.
That's right, Jess. So Pittsburgh Mayor Ed Ganey speaking for the first time about this sudden resignation. The man he nominated to be the permanent police chief. The mayor was at a public safety forum in Carrick tonight where residents brought up the resignation.
He deserves to be treated better. So when he came to me and told me, listen, this is having an impact on my family, this is having an impact on my mom, it meant something to him. I think that it just got too much. You know, I mean, I'll be honest, we wanted him, but, you know, going through that whole process of again and again, he got to answer this question, he got to do this, that, and the third. Another chief was going through that. He shouldn't have had to go through that. No other chief coming through went through that.
You asked him about 2 weeks ago, Chief, do you want this job? And he answered yes.
Yes, he did.
And then what happened?
That's what happened. What happened was the process kept switching up. They kept putting on more demands. They kept trying to make situations where, you know, they wanted, he just was uncomfortable with the
city
process.
City council, you mean?
You heard him say it today, yes, city council.
Christopher Ragland says he grew frustrated with the process when city council delayed his confirmation and community groups called for 6 neighborhood meetings. City council would interview Ragland, and that interview process would be under oath, something that has never happened before. Council made that change after the last police chief, Larry Scarrato, decided to pursue refereeing for college basketball. He was on the job for only 14 months. Ragland, meantime, also suggested a member or members of council wanted him to promote certain people in exchange for their approval to make him chief. He says while this process was playing out, he didn't think he could lead the Bureau morally or ethically, and that he said that his nomination had become a political football that wouldn't get decided before the primary election for Pittsburgh mayor in May. And tonight, I spoke with the other 3 mayoral candidates about this. Take a listen.
He wanted the job, and now he just doesn't. And this is one of the things that we're used to in Pittsburgh, is there's no transparency in city government whatsoever.
How the mayor was portraying it is this individual wanted the job. this individual was his choice. And now his choice is bailing out on the city of Pittsburgh.
I feel bad for the police officers because there's disarray in our department. They now feel like they're being ridiculed. We can't keep a chief. Our leadership can't make a decision.
And Mayor Ganey wouldn't say exactly when Christopher Raglin told him that he was pulling out, that he was resigning. And meantime, Assistant Chief Marty Devine will take.
Get started. I'd like to remind you that the views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of WRCD Pittsburgh and its members.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Now, going through with these cuts will make the world less healthy, less safe, and less prosperous. The reduction of America's humanitarian role and influence will run counter to American interests globally.
UN officials and senior USAID leaders are warning hundreds of thousands of people could die across the globe as President Trump cuts off funding for critical programs fighting AIDS, malaria, polio, and more. On Wednesday, Trump suffered a setback as the Supreme Court rejected his bid to freeze $2 billion in foreign aid. We'll speak to a lawyer from Public Citizen and the head of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, which sued Trump. Then Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Brett Murphy at ProPublica.
We found internal memos that were detailing the millions of lives that were at stake and the warnings that were put in front of the Secretary of State. Instead of heeding those warnings, the top leadership thwarted a lot of those people inside of the agency.
We'll also speak to the South African anthropologist Catherine Mathers at Duke University. She says the humanitarian industrial complex should be dismantled, but not by a billionaire-backed administration with no plan beyond abandonment. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump suffered a setback at the Supreme Court Wednesday when justices issued a 5-4 ruling rejecting a request by the Trump administration to keep frozen $2 billion in foreign aid. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the court's three liberal justices in the majority. The case was brought by the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition and other groups who are seeking to unfreeze foreign aid that had already been appropriated by Congress. In its one-paragraph ruling, the court instructed Federal District Judge Amir Ali to, quote, clarify what obligations the government must fulfill in order to comply with a temporary restraining order the judge issued on February 13th. Judge Ali has faced numerous threats over the past month after he ordered the Trump administration to restore the $2 billion in funding. In late February, Trump advisor Elon Musk called for his firing, writing, quote, when judges egregiously undermine the democratic will of the people, they must be fired, unquote. Several users on the Musk-owned social media platform X have also posted death threats against Ali. We'll have more on this ruling after headlines. President Trump's expected to issue an executive order as early as today to start dismantling the Department of Education. Although it would take an act of Congress to fully dissolve the agency, a draft presidential memo orders Education Secretary Linda McMahon to take all necessary steps permitted by law. Those steps are likely to include cuts to the workforce and education programs. This comes as the country's largest labor union, the National Education Association, and the ACLU are suing the Education Department for threatening to withhold federal funding to schools that engage in DEI efforts. That's diversity, equity, and inclusion. The ACLU called the Trump administration's move, quote, a blatant attack on free speech and academic freedom, aiming to deprive students of a full and honest education, unquote. The Department of Veterans Affairs is moving to slash some 80,000 jobs. The VA's labor force grew under the Biden administration largely to help implement the PACT Act, which expanded benefits for veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. Meanwhile, a federal judge has blocked the Trump administration from cutting National Institutes of Health research funding, siding with 22 Democratic attorneys general, medical associations, and universities that argued the administration failed to follow correct procedures and that the cuts would make crucial scientific research non-viable. In related news, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. announced last week his department would no longer allow public comments in its rulemaking process, ending a 50-year policy to involve public opinion in HHS decisions. In related news, the staff of the U.S. African Development Foundation blocked DOGE workers, including Trump ally Peter Morocco, he's deputy acting head of USAID, from entering its offices on Wednesday. The DOGE workers eventually left but threatened to return today with U.S. Marshals. The Trump administration announced a one-month exemption on auto tariffs for Mexico and Canada after President Trump spoke with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and pleas from the big three U.S. automakers, Ford, General Motors, and Stellantis. 25% tariffs on all other goods remain in effect. Canada and China have imposed retaliatory tariffs on U.S. products, while Mexico said it would announce their own countermeasures on Sunday. President Claudia Sheinbaum said Mexico could seek new trading partners in light of Trump's trade war.
If needed, we'll look for other commercial partners, anything to protect Mexico and Mexicans within the framework of sovereignty and dignity.
The U.S. has suspended intelligence sharing with Ukraine in the latest blow to Ukraine's effort to counter Russia's invasion after Trump froze military funding to Kyiv following his White House confrontation with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Senate Democrats Wednesday introduced a series of resolutions condemning Russia and calling for it to withdraw from Ukraine. President Zelensky's in Brussels today, where he thanked European leaders for their strong support. EU members are gathering for a summit as they scramble to rally support for Kyiv amidst the fallout with the Trump administration. On Wednesday, French President Emmanuel Macron said in a televised address, Europe can no longer rely on the U.S. to be, quote, at our side, and that it's considering extending its nuclear umbrella to European allies.
Answering to the historic call of the future German chancellor, I decided to open a strategic debate on the protection through our nuclear dissuasion of our allies in the European continent. If a country can invade with impunity its neighbor in Europe, then no one can no longer be sure of anything.
The Kremlin blasted President Macron's speech as extremely confrontational. European countries say they're planning for a possible influx of Ukrainian refugees after the U.S. halted its funding to Kyiv. More than 4 million Ukrainians were under temporary asylum protections in European countries as of last December. Inside Ukraine, a Russian missile attack killed 4 people and injured dozens of others late Wednesday at a hotel in the central city of Kryvyi Rih, which is President Zelensky's hometown. Late Tuesday, a Russian drone attack killed at least one person and cut off power, water, and heating in the Black Sea port of Odessa. This Odessa resident says the fighting is now at its most intense since the start of the war.
In the beginning of the war, more drones were being shot down. It has been scary, but we felt like we were protected. Now they're falling on our heads like flies. They exploded around the house. Our house was completely blown out. One of the drones hit the house directly.
Leaders of the Arab League have agreed to Egypt's $53 billion five-year proposal to rebuild the Gaza Strip without permanently displacing its more than 2 million residents, as President Trump proposed. The reconstruction plan seeks to first clear rubble from Gaza's main highway while building temporary housing for 1.2 million people left homeless by Israel's U.S.-backed assault. Later phases would see at least 400,000 permanent homes built, water, sanitation, power, and telecommunications restored, and the reconstruction of Gaza's seaport and international airport. Separately, the White House has confirmed reports it's engaging in direct negotiations with Hamas for the first time, aimed at securing the release of 21-year-old Israeli hostage Eitan Alexander and the bodies of four others. A proposal approved by Trump's Mideast envoy Steve Witkoff calls on Hamas to release half its remaining hostages in exchange for a ceasefire extension and a promise to negotiate a more lasting truce. The proposal makes no mention of releasing more Palestinian prisoners, a key demand of Palestinian negotiators. On Wednesday, President Trump issued what he called a last warning to Hamas to release the remaining Israeli hostages, adding, quote, to the people of Gaza, a beautiful future awaits, but not if you hold hostages. If you do, you are dead, unquote. Here in New York, police officers in riot gear arrested nine people at Barnard College Wednesday after student protesters occupied the school's main library to demand administrators divest from the Israeli economy and grant amnesty to three Barnard students expelled for joining pro-Palestinian protests on campus. The students declared Barnard's Milstein Center the Dr. Hassam Abu Safiya Liberated Zone. The arrest came after Barnard reported a bomb threat at the library. Protesters said the threat was manufactured by Barnard administrators and pointed out police brought zip-tied students back inside the library even as the bomb threat remained active. No other buildings were evacuated. In South Carolina, death row prisoner Brad Keith Sigman is scheduled to be killed by firing squad Friday in the state's first ever use of that execution method and the first firing squad execution in the U.S. in 15 years. Sigman's lawyer has called for clemency for his client, who he says suffers from mental illness, brain damage, and the effects of drug abuse. Sigman's lawyer says he chose execution by firing squad due to fears over lethal injection, which is, quote, shrouded in secrecy. The Justice Department has filed a motion to dismiss a Biden-era lawsuit that sought to compel Idaho's federally funded hospitals to provide abortions in medical emergencies. The case could have implications nationwide, as pregnant people with serious complications could be denied emergency care, even if it's expected to kill them. Idaho is one of 12 states that have imposed abortion bans since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in 2022. Another four states have banned abortions after 6 weeks of gestation. On Capitol Hill, Democratic mayors from Boston, Chicago, Denver, and New York appeared before a House panel Wednesday amidst Trump's threats to withhold funding for so-called sanctuary cities that impede his crackdown on immigrants. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu forcefully rebutted Republican lies that immigrants make cities less safe.
You could pass bipartisan legislation, and that would be comprehensive immigration law. The false narrative is that immigrants in general are criminals, or immigrants in general cause all sorts of danger and harm. That is actually what is undermining safety in our communities. If you wanted to make us safe, pass gun reforms. Stop cutting Medicaid. Stop cutting cancer research. Stop cutting funds for veterans. That is what will make our city safe.
Mayor Michelle Wu arrived at the congressional hearing with her newborn daughter. The New York Immigration Coalition blasted the hearing as a sham, which was held as a, quote, opportunity for extremist MAGA Republicans to spew hate and distortions about immigration, unquote. Texas Democratic Congressmember Sylvester Turner has died at the age of 70. His cause of death has not yet been revealed, but he was working just hours before his death, appearing at Trump's Capitol Hill speech Tuesday night. Turner was previously a Texas state legislator and mayor of Houston. He was sworn in as U.S. representative in January. Virginia Republican Governor Glenn Youngkin has pardoned a white police officer just days after a judge sentenced him to 3 years in prison for fatally shooting an unarmed black man accused of shoplifting two pairs of sunglasses from a shopping mall outside Washington, D.C. Officer Wesley Shiflett was sentenced on Friday to 3 years in prison after a jury found him guilty of reckless handling of a firearm for chasing 37-year-old Timothy Johnson into a dark wooded area and firing two bullets at him. The prosecutor condemned Youngkin's pardon, writing, quote, Glenn Youngkin has spent the last 4 years honing his Trump impersonation. This is an insult to all Virginians who value an untainted justice system, he said. Meanwhile, Elon Musk has joined calls for President Trump to pardon ex-Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who was convicted of murdering George Floyd in 2020. A Trump pardon would end Chauvin's 20-year sentence on federal convictions for violating Floyd's civil rights, but Trump does not have the power to commute Chauvin's 22-and-a-half-year sentence on state murder charges. Faith leaders gathered in Washington, D.C. yesterday to mark the Christian holy day of Ash Wednesday and to condemn the Trump administration and Elon Musk's attacks on the poor. They shared the findings of a new report by the Institute for Policy Studies, the Economic Policy Institute, and Repairers of the Breach, detailing how Trump and the Republican Party are taking more services and money away from working people while cutting taxes for the wealthiest. This is Reverend Dr. William Barber.
Elected technocrat can delete the financial commitments of a government established for the people and by the people, and we don't say anything. We betray our moral commitments to liberty.
And congratulations to Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous and his colleagues at Al Jazeera for winning the RTS Television Journalism Award last night for their Fault Lines documentary, The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza. Director Kavitha Shakuru dedicated the award to journalists in Gaza. The film was executive produced by Leila Alarian. You can see our interview with Sharif and Kavi about the film at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump suffered a setback at the Supreme Court Wednesday when justices issued a 5-4 ruling rejecting a request by the Trump administration to keep frozen $2 billion in foreign aid. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett joined the court's three liberal justices in the majority. The case was brought by the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition and other groups who are seeking to unfreeze foreign aid that had already been appropriated by Congress. In its one-paragraph ruling, the court instructed federal district judge Amir Ali to, quote, clarify what obligations the government must fulfill, unquote, in order to comply with a temporary restraining order the judge issued on February 13th. Judge Ali has faced numerous threats over the past month after he ordered the Trump administration to restore the $2 billion in funding. In late February, Trump advisor Elon Musk called for his firing, writing, quote, when judges egregiously undermine the democratic will of the people, they must be fired, unquote. Several users on the Musk-owned social media platform X have also posted death threats against Judge Ali. Reuters reports Musk has lambasted Ali and other judges in more than 30 posts since the end of January, calling them corrupt, radical, and evil. We're joined in Washington, D.C. by two guests. Mitchell Warren is executive director of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, one of the groups that sued the Trump administration. He's a longtime advocate for expanding access to HIV prevention. Among his many other roles, he's member of the PEPFAR Scientific Advisory Board. He's in Washington along with Nicholas Sansone, an attorney at Public Citizen Litigation Group, which brought the lawsuit. Welcome you both to Democracy Now! Nicholas, let's begin with you. Just explain the judge's ruling, the Supreme Court's ruling yesterday, and what this means.
So the Supreme Court's ruling yesterday essentially vindicates the district judge's power to enforce his own orders. We brought this lawsuit to challenge the executive's unlawful blanket termination and suspension of virtually all foreign assistance projects throughout the world. That was an abuse of executive power, and it caused immediate harm across the globe to our clients, to American businesses that provide foreign assistance, and of course to the global constituencies of those organizations. So we asked the district judge to enter a temporary restraining order, essentially putting the foreign assistance freeze on hold while the litigation continued and while we pressed our legal claims that the freeze was an abuse of executive power. After the judge entered this temporary restraining order requiring the executive branch to lift the foreign assistance freeze, the executive took no steps toward compliance, restoring none of the funding, renewing access to no grant money, and restarting none of the projects upon which communities worldwide depend. So after nearly 2 weeks of noncompliance, the court entered an order requiring the government to take specific steps towards complying with the temporary restraining order by a date certain. That's the order that the government appealed and that the Supreme Court upheld yesterday, essentially requiring the government to stop flouting the temporary restraining order and immediately lift the foreign assistance freeze while this litigation continues.
Nicholas, can you give us some examples of some of the programs that got defunded, but also explain, it's not only that Congress appropriated the money, right? It is that the money, in a lot of cases, it's paying back for services already rendered.
That's absolutely correct. And Congress has earmarked funds for particular sorts of projects. So our client, the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, who you'll hear from in a moment, they do essential work on HIV and AIDS prevention research, the sort of work that Congress has expressly directed the executive to put foreign assistance funding towards. So whatever policy disagreements the current State Department has with the work that Congress has directed it to fund, the executive doesn't have the authority to override congressional directives in that way. Another one of our clients, the Journalism Development Network, they do global work protecting journalists who are exposing corruption in governments worldwide. Our clients have had to substantially cut down their operations, terminate staff, and that's really just the tip of the iceberg. The scale of the foreign assistance funding freeze has been catastrophic and unprecedented. Food has been left rotting in warehouses that would otherwise be distributed to victims of famine. Children have been left without essential medicines. In some cases, lives have been lost. Aid workers have been stranded in hostile areas without access to emergency medical care. And there has been no justification for this dramatic action by the executive branch that, again, we maintain was an abuse of its constitutional authority.
Can you talk about Justice Alito in his dissent, calling the majority's decision, that's the Chief Justice, John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett, stunning, arguing a single judge shouldn't have the power to compel $2 billion in payments?
What's stunning here is the extent of the executive branch's failure to comply with a clear court order requiring it to lift the foreign assistance freeze. To be clear, there is nothing unusual about judges ordering a likely unlawful practice. There was a judicial determination that this foreign assistance freeze was likely unlawful. And it is very par for the course for judges, once they have made that initial determination and where they have determined that irreparable harm is likely to be suffered if the unlawful practice is not paused while the litigation continues, it's very common for judges to enter temporary restraining orders requiring a return to the status quo before an unlawful practice was instituted while the case sort of makes its way through the courts. What the only reason that this case found itself at the Supreme Court at this stage is the fact that the government took no steps to comply with the temporary restraining order, requiring the district judge to sort of put his foot down and say, look, there has been no evidence that you have taken any action to lift the foreign assistance freeze. So I'm going to require you to make certain funds available by tomorrow. You've had 2 weeks already to do this, and you haven't.
I want to bring in Mitchell Warren, Executive Director of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, or AVAC. Also on the board of the PEPFAR organization, which was PEPFAR, of course, a major project of President George W. Bush. Can you talk about the work you do and what this funding freeze has meant for you and for people around the world?
Thank you so much for having me, and really appreciate you bringing light into what's happening. This is not just a legal case. This is about foreign assistance that for 60 years has been the backbone of U.S. diplomacy. Every president has made decisions about what that policy might look like, but it's been a core tenet of every administration of all political stripes that foreign assistance matters. PEPFAR, as you described, for 20 years, first founded by President Bush, has been the most life-saving program imaginable in global health, and AVAC is just one small part of it. We're a small advocacy organization focused on HIV prevention, and right now what's most alarming is that we stand in one of the greatest moments in HIV prevention, as PEPFAR and other partners in countries and around the world are looking at the introduction of new prevention technologies. And that's a lot of the work that we do at AVAC, and really trying to make sure those products get developed and then get delivered to prevent new infections. And so projects around the world were stopped a month ago. And for no good reason, and with no clear strategy. No one's arguing that an administration can't make policy changes. And of course, that's in their purview. But you do it in a way that follows process and follows the law. And that's all that we're talking about here. If you want to make changes, describe them, articulate them, and work together with the implementing partners and with host countries to ensure that people have healthy lives and that countries and economies stay robust. And what is remarkable is that PEPFAR has demonstrated for 20 years that it is truly the project that makes America and the world safer, stronger, and more prosperous, precisely what this administration describes as their policy. So it working in complete opposition to what they're actually saying, and clearly acting in a capricious, vindictive way.
An official at the Desmond Tutu HIV Center is warning the funding cuts to HIV projects could lead to 500,000 deaths in South Africa over the next 10 years, Mitchell?
Exactly. You know, PEPFAR over 20 years has helped to save, get 20 million people on antiretroviral therapy that saves lives and prevents infections. Millions of people's lives have been saved. And, you know, remember, George Bush started this with bipartisan support because people were dying, and PEPFAR has ensured that people are living and economies are growing, and the United States benefits from that. And South Africa has been the epicenter of the epidemic. I worked there throughout the 1990s, setting up the first HIV prevention programs at the beginning of the epidemic, when HIV and AIDS was actually a death sentence. Now it's not. But if we don't allow drug supplies to happen, and as Nicholas was describing, there are many ramifications, not just in HIV with food rotting, but also medicines in shipping containers destined for countries around the world. Even if the new administration wants to stop that program, you've already made the investment. You've spent the money, appropriated by Congress to procure those antiretrovirals, to deliver them, and now people can't actually access them, and people will die. And it's not just about HIV, tuberculosis, malaria. We have an issue with, you know, the executive orders coming in January were concurrent with an Ebola outbreak in Uganda. So you're seeing the inability to do surveillance of outbreaks and to deal with emerging pandemics as well as HIV. And so you're seeing ramifications left, right, and center. We may not see the numbers tomorrow. People won't die tomorrow without antiretroviral therapy. But if they fall out of therapy, they will get sick, they're more likely to transmit the virus, and they will die. And we'll see those numbers coming up in the months and years ahead.
During his address to Congress on Tuesday night, President Trump highlighted several foreign aid cuts already made, including this one.
$8 million for making mice transgender. This is real.
In fact, it's not real. Rolling Stone and other outlets have documented that the funding Trump seems to have referred to was actually not for transgender mice, but for transgenic lab mice used in medical studies for cancer and asthma research. Mitchell Warren, if you can talk about the lies that have been perpetrated, I mean, going through to when Elon Musk was challenged, when his child was on his shoulders in the Oval Office, talking about when he had said that $50 million was going to Gaza for condoms, when told, no, in fact, that is a complete lie. That isn't true. That there were condoms going to the Gaza region of Mozambique. He said, okay, something like we all make mistakes. But what this is meant to do when they continually ridicule, mock what they call corrupt programs that they're cutting, what in fact is happening, Mitchell?
What in fact is happening are lies to actually create a mythology amongst their supporters that foreign aid is somehow evil. You know, before January 20th, I would expect that 99% of Americans didn't even know what USAID was. Most people have now heard that acronym, but they don't actually know what it does. And for 60 years, it has provided immunization, disease surveillance, antiretroviral therapy, bed nets, condoms in lots of places that are urgently needed to prevent infections and to prevent unintended pregnancy. And now we see these lies that are entire fabrications. And when I heard that speech and those lies, and I heard the laughter coming from our elected officials in Congress, I was appalled. And these are members of Congress who historically, across both parties, have supported foreign assistance. And to be laughing at what the president's making up. You know, one of the things that was also remarkable, he criticized the investment of circumcision in Mozambique. And it showed the complete ignorance of the science. Voluntary medical male circumcision for 20 years has been proven to be one of the most effective forms of HIV prevention. It was actually studied with funding from the National Institutes of Health, a great example of NIH leadership in science. We've shown that circumcision prevents HIV infection by upwards to 70%. And now we have a president of the United States who mocks it as if it's a joke. It has saved lives. It's one of the most high-impact, cost-effective interventions. So there are lies, as you described, with transgenic mice that actually help advance the development of vaccines as well as cures. It is just a willful ignorance, a willful disregard of science, and an intentional effort to undermine democracy, frankly, because when you undermine science, when you undermine evidence, you're undermining democracy.
Very quickly, you're a member of the Scientific Advisory Board of the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, known as PEPFAR, George W. Bush's project. Has the former president weighed in?
The George Bush Institute that he is named for him in Texas has been a staunch supporter of PEPFAR and continues to explain what PEPFAR is doing, why it is the most data-driven, why it is the most evidence-based intervention we've seen, honestly, in the history of global health. And I hope that Democrats and Republicans, including Marco Rubio, it's important to note that Secretary of State Rubio, when he was Senator Rubio, was one of PEPFAR's biggest supporters. So we need to remind people what they said, what they believed, and to stop this willful disregard of congressional authority and of science.
And finally, to Nicholas Sansone, you're back in court today, right? You're back in the judge's court. And what is going to happen? What is the course of events now? Is it possible that even after the Supreme Court ruling that the president, that Elon Musk, won't have the $2 billion in funds unfrozen?
The court's order is clear. It's not optional at this point. The government must comply. And today in court, we expect to make that case to the district judge. And we expect there to be clear steps laid out as to exactly what the government must do to lift this unlawful funding freeze while our case continues and when the government must act by. So we will be speaking with the judge and with the government counsel this afternoon, and we expect to know more about what circumstances on the ground are going to look like After that.
Well, we'll continue to follow this, of course. Nicholas Sansone of Public Citizen Litigation Group and Mitchell Warren, Executive Director of the AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition. Coming up, internal memos show senior USAID leaders have warned Trump appointees that closing the agency will lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. Stay with us. Also, Blue Sky by Grouper. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We continue to look at how the Trump administration's cuts to the U.S. Agency for International Development are likely to cause enormous human suffering, leading to increased death and disability, accelerated disease spread, political instability, and heightened threats to U.S. national security. That's according to internal USAID memos. One leaked memo has a chart for different program areas and the expected global case increase over 1 year if programs are permanently halted. For malaria, an additional 12.5 to 17.9 million cases, with up to 166,000 additional deaths each year. For tuberculosis, a 28 to 32% increase in estimated incidence globally. For Ebola, worst case scenario, more than 28,000 cases. Polio, an additional 200,000 paralytic polio cases a year over the next decade. The memo also projects 1 million children will lose treatment for severe acute malnutrition each year. It was written by USAID's Acting Assistant Administrator for Global Health, Nicholas Enrich. Over the weekend, Enrich was placed on administrative leave. For more, we're joined by Brett Murphy, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at ProPublica, where his new piece on this is headlined, Internal Memos, Senior USAID Leaders Warn Trump Appointees of Hundreds of Thousands of Deaths from Closing Agency. Over the weekend, he also had a piece headlined, The Trump Administration Said These Aid Programs Saved Lives. It canceled them anyway. Welcome back, Brett, to Democracy Now! Amy. So just lay out what you found, where these memos come from, how they got circulated, and also the fact that the person who wrote them was laid off. Not to mention, well, a few weeks ago, the Inspector General at USAID put out a report, was also laid off, or should we say fired?
Sure. So most of the agency at this point has been put on administrative leave. It's a skeleton staff there. And what's important to note, where, you know, this is all coming from. For the past several weeks, the administration had said it's conducting this review of all of its programs at USAID. During this review, they effectively paused, halted almost everything that the agency had been funding. During that time, they said there was this waiver. They kept saying there was a waiver for life-saving programs. This caused confusion around the world because nobody knew if they qualified, if they did qualify, how to apply. So there's all this confusion both internally and around the world.
Not to mention a lot of the international staff was told to get back to the United States.
Exactly. And nobody was able to communicate with the contractors and aid organizations who are doing this work. So they didn't know if they could qualify for this waiver. And at the same time, nobody was receiving money. So for work they had already done, they weren't getting reimbursed. For new work, they weren't getting paid. Lots of confusion. And then at the agency, this bureau, Global Health, was trying to put forth programs that they thought qualified for this waiver. And they were making the case for each one of these individual programs, all the ones you just enumerated. Enrich and others were saying that lives depended on these. And this is not low-level staffers. These are the senior-most authorities in global health in the government saying unequivocally, we are trying to implement the administration's own policy. The administration is saying publicly there should be a life-saving waiver for these programs. Let us do it. We want to apply the waiver. They were not allowed to apply the waiver. Time and again, they detailed in these memos different instances in which they wanted to conduct a review, put forth a program, and then get funding reinstated for those programs, but they weren't allowed to. In one of the incidents we reported on, there was a DOGE advisor who wrote to the Global Health Bureau and said, we heard you guys are conducting a review. You should not be doing that. That's getting in the way of the terminations. We want to terminate the programs. Another official, another political appointee at the agency said the same thing. He said, we want to be draconian with how we're approaching these reviews. They want to err towards termination and not review. This is in stark contrast with what the administration has been saying, which is we want to conduct a careful case-by-case review of each one of these programs, and then if they don't align with the Trump administration's policy, we want to cut the programs. The evidence has been that they're doing the opposite, that they're cutting these en masse instead. That's what these memos detailed.
I mean, I remember when Elon Musk was in the White House, in the Oval Office, standing next to President Trump, and he said, for example, we cut Ebola, but then we restored it right away. But that's not what the experts are saying, the people involved with the programs.
I talked to a doctor in Uganda who was doing Ebola contamination. He told me we received a termination notice last week telling us to immediately cease all of our programs. They're one of very few clinics who are doing that work in Uganda. And he said, we have had to close up shop. Hopefully the Ministry of Health in Uganda will take it over. But for them to say that they reinstated Ebola programs is categorically wrong, because we've talked to the mission directors who said that we cannot do the work and our work is Ebola.
And why this matters, for example, with Ebola, why it matters to the people who are suffering from it there and why it matters to people in the United States.
The work they do, and people will remember, I think, some of these terms from the COVID era, like contact tracing, screening at airports. This is the work that they do. They figure out this is how you contain an outbreak, something as deadly as Ebola, which has something like a 50% fatality rate. Around the country, they contain the spread of a disease like that so it doesn't make its way to an airport, so it doesn't make its way stateside. That's the type of work that they do. It's literally life-saving work.
Talk about tuberculosis.
Same with TB. TB is a respiratory illness, just like COVID is. And it doesn't get talked about quite as much as HIV or Ebola, but we've been speaking with doctors and longtime aid groups who have been in Africa who said this is their real concern. If we are cutting TB work, the outbreaks could be enormous on a scale that they haven't seen in decades. And this is sort of, you know, one of the tent poles of USAID has been TB containment in Africa, and they're extremely worried about it.
So explain what happened to Nicholas Enrich, who wrote these memos, and how the administration has responded now that this information has gotten out, and they've been warned hundreds of thousands of people will die as President Trump mocks transgender mice, which wasn't even true. That's become sort of the symbol of USAID, and also the inspector general before him.
They've erected certain examples like this throughout. They did it before, as you were mentioning, with the condoms in Gaza. Your other guest made the point that the administration has the purview to look at certain programs and decide whether or not they align with the policy. That's just not what they've been doing. It's just not what's been happening. They cut everything at once. And now they're actually in the process of reversing some of those terminations. They seem to be unsure of what they've cut. They've been soliciting information from their own contract officers, from aid organizations, asking if their program got cut. So they seem to be reversing. We did another story a couple days ago about they went after programs inside of the Inspector General's office, which USAID does not have control over. The IG's office is independent. It has to be. So just as an example of kind of what has been described as a haphazard and kind of chaotic process, they cut the cell phone service of Inspector General officials throughout the agency, including the ones based overseas, Haiti and Ukraine, For 24 hours, nobody had cell phone service because they cut the contract with AT&T over an office that they do not have control over. So people have been making the case to me for weeks now that this is the opposite of a careful review. And they've been saying in court, this is a careful review. We're allowed to do a careful review. Everyone at the agency and everyone who's had their programs cut says, obviously, it's not a careful review because they're making mistakes and they're overturning their own terminations. And they seem unclear of it now. So this is, they just cut everything at once and now they're going backwards.
And it's very difficult to get back in touch, especially with their own workers, because when they fire them, they cut off their email. And so then they don't know how to reach them.
These people on administrative leave across the agency have had their access to the systems completely cut off. So we're talking about most of the workforce at this agency, the ones who would be doing the work of like helping these programs get back online. They're not able to work right now. They're not working. They're effectively dismissed. So there's really nobody to help these programs get back online and approve the payments that they need.
I want to ask you about one particular man. As part of the Trump administration's push to cut U.S. foreign aid, DOGE announced Tuesday it had cut the staff for the Inter-American Foundation from 48 workers to one. The agency's newly installed head, Trump loyalist Peter Morocco, acting deputy administrator for USAID. Morocco was reportedly part of a closed-door meeting Wednesday with members of the House Foreign Affairs Committee and told them the administration may bring criminal referrals against workers at USAID over allegations of misuse of foreign assistance. Also Wednesday, staff at the U.S. African Development Foundation reportedly blocked DOGE staffers from entering their office, where Trump is also trying to install Pete Morocco to gut the agency. So, Brett, you have reported on Peter Morocco in a story headlined Trump official destroying USAID secretly met with Christian nationalists abroad in defiance of U.S. policy. As we begin to wrap up, lay out what you found.
This was back in 2018. Previous Trump administration, Pete Morocco was at the State Department. He had done short stints at multiple agencies, DOD, USAID, Commerce, and State. He was over there on a diplomatic mission to Bosnia-Herzegovina. Left the reservation without talking to the ambassador, met with Serb separatists inside of Bosnia-Herzegovina, including the president, Milorad Dodik. At the time, Dodik was under U.S. sanctions by the Trump administration for trying to undermine the peace agreements that we very carefully drew up in the 90s after the genocide.
At the Dayton Accords.
At the Dayton Accords, yes. He was, Milorad Dodik had been accused of undermining these. He has said publicly he's anti-American, anti-West, and he's pro-Russian, and he wants a Serb nationalist state, Christian nationalist state, and this very much undermines U.S. policy, and that's what got Morocco in hot water back in 2018. He has since been the one behind.
Wasn't he basically fired at that point?
He left the agency. We don't exactly know the circumstances under which he left the State Department, but from there he went to USAID. He finished the last administration at aid, and he ran into problems there as well. So a lot of the people said that his treatment of the agency now is reflective of what he had tried to do back then. He was trying to do reviews all the time, reviews of every single program that he didn't think aligned with his own version of foreign policy or what he thought Trump's version of foreign policy should be. He wanted to cut things, and now he's cutting things.
Well, Brett Murphy, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at ProPublica. We'll link to your articles on USAID. Coming up, we speak to an anthropologist who says the humanitarian industrial complex should be dismantled, but not by a billionaire-backed administration with no plan beyond abandonment. Back in 20 seconds.
Easy. Pull out your heart to me. Easy. Pull out your heart to me. Being alone. Easy.
Easy by Sun Lux. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at a critique of the role of the U.S. Agency for International Development and other international aid agencies, the role they play in the Global South. We're joined now by Catherine Mathers, an anthropologist and professor at Duke University. Her new piece for the website Africa is a Country is headlined The Wrong Way to End Aid. She writes, the humanitarian industrial complex should be dismantled, but not by a billionaire-backed administration with no plan beyond abandonment. Professor Mathers is the author of two books, Travel, Humanitarianism, and Becoming American in Africa, and White Saviorism and Popular Culture, Imagined Africa as a Space for American Salvation. Professor Mathers is a co-producer of the forthcoming documentary, When I Say Africa. Professor Mathers, welcome to Democracy Now! As you look at what's happening at USAID, the complete dismantling of this agency, can you share your critique of the agency, but what you think must be done?
Yes, I referenced Teju Cole's framing of the humanitarian industrial complex, because I think USAID is very much part of a system, an industry that not only depends on global inequality, global suffering, but in many ways produces it, reproduces it. So I have for a long time critiqued the system and these structures because I do think they do often more harm than the good that they are trying to or claiming to do. I think that this is a complex that renders the causes of global inequality invisible, hiding the ways that often U.S. policies, U.S. trade agreements, and other forms of sort of extractive capitalism are often the causes of these crises, these challenges that people around the world have, that then aid steps into to help or to solve. But in fact, it's not solving it at all, because it's making sure that we never, ever ask the questions, why is it that the United States has the resources, has the power to help in this way, while other people are often suffering in ways that are caused by the U.S.'s own policies. And it's that sort of paradox that I was trying to grapple with, because, of course, suddenly taking away what are, in fact, necessary, as we just heard earlier in the show, necessary programs that help people who need help is certainly just a bull in a china shop. And doing, again, only harm. So it is, for me, a complicated paradox, because if I argued for any kind of changes, it would be that a country like the U.S. should be offering reparations for the climate damage that they've done in the Global South, in the interest of their own economies, in the interest of their own lifestyle. And certainly one would like to see a sort of thoughtful set of plans and questions around what is it that a country like the U.S. is doing to produce this kind of inequality, to produce reproduce the inability of countries like South Africa, for example, in making its own HIV medication and providing it to its people. And so there is this danger, I think, of produced by the humanitarian industrial complex that allows people to go, well, we're doing the right thing, we're doing a good thing, but allows them to feel okay about their implication, their participation in a system that, in fact, helps to produce and reproduce that poverty or that inequality.
You've worked with USAID-funded projects in adult literacy and voter education in South Africa. And you write that the work was largely dependent on Western donor funding, but, quote, it always came with strings, especially the money from USAID. What kind of strings are you talking about? How do you think USAID's goal is ultimately about supporting the U.S. economy? And that's a really interesting point. People may not realize, for example, that millions and millions of dollars go to peanut farmers in the United States to provide a substance that goes to babies and children to fight malnutrition. But the money doesn't go to those other countries. It goes directly to the farmers in the U.S.
Exactly. And certainly USAID does not make any, is not deluded about this. It works in the interest of the United States and of the U.S. economy and of its own sort of sense of self in the world, at least before this month. But a large amount of its budget, small as it is, in fact, as you just described, goes back to U.S. industries, to U.S. farmers, to U.S. manufacturers, and even with a small project like ours, which is not buying anything, so we got to use that money on our programming. A large amount of it goes to the auditors in D.C., for example. So it is a sort of cycle of, you know, we're giving you money for this, but much of it ends up coming back to the U.S. So, in fact, it does its job of supporting sort of U.S. interests to a large degree. The other sort of set of strings, in a way, was that it was never really possible for an organization like us to just do our work. Project Literacy had a sustainable working structure that was doing really good adult basic education, literacy, numeracy, financial education. But to just get funding from an agency like USAID, and it's certainly not unique in this way, was almost impossible. You know, give us funding to do the work we already do. We can prove we do it. It's really successful. And so every 6 months, you're writing funding proposals that are bending our work into the current sexy language about what matters in aid or development. And what matters in aid or development is decided in D.C., in New York, in London, in Geneva. It's not decided on the ground where people are doing the work. And there's this reluctance to support that.
I wanted to ask you, Professor Mathers, about the history of critiquing USAID in many parts of the world when it's been used, for example, as a front for the CIA. I'd like to mention a couple of examples from Latin America. Back in 2010, USAID covertly funded a Twitter-like social media platform in Cuba to spark a Cuban spring with the hope of bringing down the government. Last week, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Greg Grandin spoke to Al Jazeera's Upfront about USAID. This is what he said.
AID is a perfect expression of a kind of the fusion of hard and soft power. I mean, it does important and humane work, and I think it was funding the only working hospital left in Gaza, things like that, and dispensing, you know, medicines in Africa, and but it was also the agency in which that funded democracy promotion programs, and these were all when the National Endowment for Democracy, which operates under AID, was founded in 1983 under the Reagan administration. The first director of it said, "We do in the open what the CIA used to do covertly," meaning that they fund oppositional groups and in countries that are out and out, you know, dissenting from U.S. hegemony, say Bolivia. You fund these organizations that basically raise the alarm that the country is heading toward dictatorship and it manipulates the press. I mean, you know, in Bolivia, the reason why that coup didn't take hold is because Evo Morales kicked out AID.
And you also have, for example, Peter Kornbluh of the National Security Archive saying among the most infamous examples of USAID funding was the Office of Public Safety, a USAID police training program in the Southern Cone that also trained torturers. We only have 20 seconds. It's not your total focus, but your thoughts on how it's been used.
I mean, I don't have doubt that it's been used that way. I have no evidence of that. It's certainly in the conversation in South Africa, for example. People would make those accusations and be frustrated about that. But I'm more interested in the way that this kind of agency shuts down South Africa's ability to solve its own problems. And
I think that is key,
that
and we're going to link to the articles you write. Professor Catherine Mathers at Duke University, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, I'm Melinda Crawford, a Scottish fiddler, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Ever lose your keys? Is that normal aging, dementia, or something else? Fear often stops us from asking for a simple checkup from the neck up. Knowing your numbers, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol are common, but your cognitive numbers are also important. Request our free guide. It's filled with tips for better brain health, facts about dementia, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
Hey, look, everyone, it's Mando.
Everybody ready?
Welcome to another episode of Whiskey Before Breakfast Radio, or the Rich Program, depending on where you are located. I am Mando Richard, and I'm going to try real hard to have a mistake-free show today. The last 2 weeks have been a little crazy, haven't they? All right, anyway, we had a Liquored Up set, a folk rock set about the middle of the show, and a gospel set at the end, so we got everything covered here. Here comes a song from the wilds of Long Island and the Feinberg Brothers.
Bar pencils, barmaids, they work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you think of your first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more. At the table in the corner is a man in a suit. His clothes have been stained from the tears and the booze. His shoes have been shined, no, he doesn't look poor. But his mind is still aching for a couple beers more. Bar pretzels, barmaids, they work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you think of your first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more. There's some men at
like the bar near the fluorescent lights. They all work together, but come here at night to escape your wife's nagging and to put off their chores. But they'll stay here together for a couple beers more. Bar pretzels, barmaids, hey, work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you think of you first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more. Too old. He's holding a girl who's been down a rough road. But the boy doesn't know what the girl has in store. So he'll be back here later for a couple beers more. Bar pretzels, barmaids, hey, work up your thirst. A hard day at work and you'll think of you first. Your troubles, they leave you once you walk through that door. Hey, your pain melts away with a couple beers more. Away with a couple beers more.